Nat Eliason, I'm so honored and thrilled to have you here since we recorded episode 33.
It's a long time ago.
And that was in December of 2020, I believe.
Yeah, that's wild.
So I'm grateful that you've come back here again for your second time on the Danny Moreno podcast.
Yeah, lots changed since then. Yeah. I haven't really been doing podcasts for the last year or so, too. So it's fun to be back on the circuit a little bit.
Yeah, what inspired that?
I was so deep down the crypto rabbit hole and doing podcasting felt like a distraction at that time because I wasn't writing very much besides the crypto writing and I was just fully focused on that and the programming all day, being plugged into charts all day, doing that nonstop. It really felt like a distraction to go do any of the podcasting type stuff. So it's nice to be back out of that world. It was fun for a period. It's a good learning experience, but definitely happy to be like back out of it again.
Yeah, that's something I really want to talk to you about is just your ability to jump into something, get so familiar with it. I feel like by the time I understand things or try to attempt to understand things, you've spent 6 months already mastering it.
Maybe.
That's how it feels. Why are you always so early on everything?
Some things. Something.
You're right.
The things I talk about.
Caveat with that. But for me, from the outside, you're like always 6 months ahead of where I am. And so if you're talking to about something, I'm like, I should probably pay attention to this thing now.
Yeah. There's pluses and minuses to it, right? Because the positive side is when it's something like crypto or that whole, you know, like Rome note-taking app battle era.
That's right. I forgot about that.
I mean, even there's like this thing with Oatly now, right? Where everybody's suddenly being like, hey, you know, Oatly is actually kind of like terrible for you. And I'm like, yeah, I was writing about that 3 years ago. Like, come on. But for some of the, I think I just get bored really easily. And then I start looking for kind of like fun, interesting things to play around with. And sometimes it turns into something interesting and sometimes it doesn't. But I mean, for the crypto one was really just a random lucky set of things lining up where I had stepped out of my marketing agency in December around when we talked and then was really like looking for something new to do. Did the YouTube thing for a little bit, ended up not liking that as much. I was briefly considering going into commercial real estate stuff and I was going to try to like build this town outside Austin and got decently far down that. And then my wife and I were trying to have a kid and she got pregnant and we're like super excited and really, really happy about it. And then in my head, I'm also going like, holy shit, like I need to make money right now. Yeah. And if you want to make a lot of money in 2021, riding the early part of the crypto wave was sort of like the no-brainer thing to jump into and explore, right? And I didn't really know what I was going to do with it or where that was going to go. And it kind of turned into a pretty wild ride from there. So it was fun.
Yeah. Well, it seemed fun, like following your journey and being in it myself for a little bit. But I'm curious about the price you paid to go down that route.
Yeah. I mean, we were talking about this a bit before the podcast started, but I mean, the first like 4 months in when I got super into crypto, it was very like, okay, I need to make as much money as possible in the next 8 months because if I don't, then I don't know what financial life is going to look like on the other side once this baby's here. You know, is it as crazy and expensive and stressful and challenging as everybody says? I just stepped out of the agency and while, you know, I could be taking profit and stuff from that, like I don't want to rely on that. I want to let it like do its own thing, right? I've got my blog and stuff. It wasn't a rational fear, but it existed nonetheless, right?
Was it conscious or unconscious?
I consciously recognized that I was stressed about money, but I think I didn't realize how strong it was until after looking back at it.
Makes sense.
But when you're really like stressed about it and trying to do whatever is necessary, you make a lot of mistakes, right? So the first few months when I was getting into it, I was just like throwing money into anything that seemed like it had a pulse and losing a bunch of money that way. I was trying to learn how to program stuff on Ethereum and like literally the first thing that I ever built let somebody else steal $30,000 from me, which was like half of all my money in crypto at the time.
Oh my God.
Awful. Yeah. It basically like, you know, you're programming stuff on Ethereum blockchain, you have to deploy your contracts, right? Like this, I need to like make this super simple. When you deploy your code, you have to use an address to deploy the code from. And when you write the code, one of the ways to deploy your contract is to like use the wallet that you're keeping all of your Ethereum and other stuff in. Terrible way to do it. Not the way you're supposed to do it, but I was like lazy and excited and just trying to move quickly. And so I was like, okay, I'll figure out how to use other wallets later. I'll just use my own for this one and put the contract up and then pushed all my code to GitHub on a public repo so I could say like, hey, look, like I know what I'm doing. Like somebody hire me, please. Like I want to build Ethereum stuff. And then I was showing Cosette, my wife, that I'd built this thing, and I was like really excited about it. And then I opened my crypto wallet, and it should have had 0.3 ETH in it or something, right? And it said zero. And I was like, that's kind of weird, right? Like, why does it say zero? It must be a bug in the UI or whatever, right? And so we go to dinner at Intero, the place I was just telling you. It's like semi-weekly. It's like the best restaurant in Austin, right? Anyway, so we go to dinner. And it's kind of like bugging me the whole time we're there.
Mm.
And I'm like, why? I've never seen that UI glitch before. It's so weird. And then we get back from dinner and I get on my computer and I look at it again and the glitch is still there. And then so I like go a little bit deeper and I look on the actual like blockchain explorer at my wallet to see, okay, it must still be there. And it's not. Oh, and like a bunch of the other money is gone too. And I'm just like, holy fuck, like what is going on? And so, I like called my friend and asked her like, hey, I need to like send you everything right now. I have no idea what's going on with my wallet. And she's like, okay, cool. Like she, gets on her laptop and I'm like, I'm sending all this stuff to Kat. And she's holding it while I'm trying to figure out what's going on. And what happened was I accidentally published the seed phrase for my wallet to GitHub.
Oh my God.
So it's basically the equivalent of like going to a public forum and posting your bank login, right? It was like the dumbest thing I could have possibly done. And people have built these scrapers that go through GitHub and look for Solidity code. Solidity is like the language that you program Ethereum smart contracts in. They look for Solidity code that like has seed phrases in it. And then as soon as they find it, they drain the wallet and they just like take everything from it. And so,
and you lost how much?
Like 30 grand.
Oh my God.
And while I was at dinner, I came back and saw, I was like, what the fuck do I do? Yeah. Right. And the only reason they didn't take all of it was some of it was on different blockchains that I think they just didn't think to look at. I had a bunch on like Phantom at the time, which was really new and up and coming, and they probably didn't have the scrapers for it. So they didn't realize that half my money was over there. They didn't realize there was money on Polygon either. They just took all the stuff on Ethereum, mm-hmm. even though they could have taken all of that too.
Wow.
So I got like super lucky.
Yeah.
And it was like that happened. There was another really close call where me and some friends put money into this project. We're all super excited about it. It turned out to be a complete rug, which means they just like took everybody's money. And we were like out playing pickleball. And one of the friends that I was just playing with was also in this project with me. And he's like, hey, somebody else on the Discord said that like the site's down. And I'm saying, oh, that's weird, right? That shouldn't happen. But whatever, I'm sure it's fine. The site will go back up. Didn't go back up. It was just gone.
Oh, and my God.
Everybody else lost everything they had put into it. The only reason I didn't was that I had basically made a mistake moving some money around in the site like the day before.
Wow.
And so everybody else had authorized this transaction that let the app take all of their money, thinking they were authorizing something else.
Wow.
I had never finished doing it, so I was still able to get my money back, but I was the only one, right? Yeah. So a few of these things happen, and the thing we were talking about before and like the toll that it started to take is like that stuff's happening. I'm getting more and more stressed about money, and then my drinking is just like going up like this, right? Like
crazy.
Really, really bad. And not like not harmful enough to, I'm not like getting in fights. I'm not fighting with Cosette. I'm not like hurting myself driving. Yeah, my wife. I'm not doing anything bad, but the like self-loathing and all of that is kind of going up with it. And just being that plugged in 24/7 was like so unhealthy. And that was kind of like the coping mechanism. And then I eventually had to say like, okay, no, like I can't have alcohol in my life anymore. Like, really, really bad. And, but the, the thing I realized later was like, that didn't actually change anything. Because then it was just like, okay, I'll find other ways to
cope.
To cope. Exactly. Yeah. Right. Like, okay, I'll smoke a bunch of weed, right? Like, right. Weed's legal now, basically, right? You can get Delta 9 stuff. So, like, I'll do that to medicate, right. Or I'll like eat a ton of, you know, ice cream, or like play a bunch of video games, right? You'll always find some other way to medicate often when there's like this external stressor that's causing the problem. And it really wasn't until I said, okay, I can't do this life anymore. Like, this isn't the money's not worth it, basically.
How did you come to that realization?
We were on a family vacation in Italy, and we were with my parents and my sister and her fiance and me and Cosette and our daughter. And, you know, we were all there, and there was this like new crypto game launching at 11 p.m. And so everybody else had gone to bed. I'd stayed up late because I had to like claim all of my crypto unicorns so I could like breed them into like more unicorns. And it's, you know, 11 p.m. in Tuscany in this like beautiful villa. And I'm just like, what the fuck am I doing? and I had like already made more money than I had like hoped or expected for from doing this, right? But it wasn't enough. It was like, oh, okay, like I can make more money. I can make more, like I can go bigger, right? Mm-hmm. I started trying to reach out to VC firms because I wanted to like, okay, I'm going to be a crypto VC now. I'm going to go do this. And like, because that's how you make the real money, right? Is like, then you get in super early. And then it's just like, okay, there will never be a point on this path where I say like, oh, okay, that's enough. And like, there'll never be a better time than now, right? Like, because once you're kind of on that track, you just keep kind of inflating your lifestyle, inflating your expectations. And if you're not, like, loving the work, then the only thing you're doing it for is just the more, 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 more. And that never ends up satisfying you. Yeah. Having a kid is, like, the best perspective changer, too. Because the thing I started asking myself was, okay, if my daughter was, like, 20 or 18 or whatever, and she came to me and she said, hey, Dad, you know, I have these two opportunities in front of me, right? Like, I can go fully pursue my writing full time and really try to like make that work, or I can be a crypto VC. I'd be like, what the fuck are you talking about? Right? Like, this isn't a question. Like, go do the writing. It's so obvious. But when you're in it, it's very hard to like give yourself that advice. But thinking about it that way helped frame it really, really well. And I think looking at her, I was like, okay, you know what? Life would I want to build over the next 15 years, 20 years that I think she would be more likely to be proud of, or that would be a good model. And it's not the life of constantly trying to get more and more money. It's like doing this thing that I'm really passionate about and trying to get really good at that.
When did you know that writing was something in your being or in your core?
That's a good question. I don't know, because it sort of feels like I stumbled into it where, you know, I wasn't like, you read stories about like, oh, these like great writers who like knew from when they were a kid, right? Like, I'm probably not ever going to be that good because I didn't know from a super early age.
You're my favorite writer.
Thank you.
So when you say I'm never going to be that good, it's just like, how does he think that?
Well, this is like the other fun thing that I've tried to really embrace is like, no matter how good you are at anything.
Yeah.
You will always have somebody else who makes you feel inferior.
Totally.
So it's kind of like this whole like Buddhist life is suffering type thing. Like there's no point where you ever go, oh, if you care about money, there's never a point where you go, oh, I have enough now.
Yeah.
Right. If you care,
there's always someone with more money. There's always somebody who's a better writer in your eyes. There's always somebody who's a better podcaster. There's always whatever you do.
Right. You look at like, I don't know who the richest person today is, if it's Elon or Jeff or whatever. Right. But like they're probably easily looking at Rockefeller and saying, oh, well, you know, inflation adjusted, he had like 300 billion. So I'm like, not really there. Right. And then, who was the king of, I don't want to mess this up. The richest man in all of history was one of the old like kings
King of
Africa,
Babylon,
right? King of Babylon was up there, but it was one of, I want to say Ghana or Mali. I can't remember which one, but like, you know, trillions of dollars inflation adjusted, right? Or more, right? And then, okay, how much money do like the sheikhs really have? Like, you can always find somebody to compare yourself to.
Right.
And same with writing, right? Yeah. It's like, oh, you know, no matter how good you are, it's like, is anybody going to read this in 2,500 years, the way that we read like Plato today?
It's a high standard.
Almost certainly not, right? There's basically no way you could ever get to that level. And so you kind of have to accept at some point that like, you're just never going to rise to those expectations.
Yeah.
But it's I mean, the thing for me is like, I just love doing it.
Yeah.
Right. And it's fun. Like, I really enjoy it. And the question I started asking myself was, and I think that the like, do what you're passionate about or whatever advice is like really bad, because you need to make money first. Mm. Or like, figure out how to make money, figure out how to like do something you can charge for and figure out that part. But once you have gotten it to some phase or some stage where you can at least tell yourself, okay, if shit hit the fan, I know I could go get a job that makes a good salary that covers my lifestyle. Mm-hmm. Once you get to that point, you should go do the thing you want to do and try to make that like catch up to that income level maybe. Mm. Right. And so for me, it was like, okay, writing as an income generator is terrible, which is why writers do a lot of other things, right?
I just launched a paid newsletter.
Yeah. And you know what? I love doing my newsletter. Yeah. I love that Substack has the paid stuff. Yeah. It will probably never come close to what you could make going into like crypto venture capital or starting a business, right, or, you know, doing all these other things that come with writing, right? Like a lot of people who are into writing are doing it to get speaking gigs, right? Because speaking gigs pay way more than books.
Right.
It's really hard to make a lot of money off of books, but you can charge 20 to 50 grand for a speaking gig if you have a popular book. Mm. And that is a much like higher guaranteed success route. But my thinking is like, I want to be super stubborn and say, no, I'm just going to write. Like, I'm not going to do any speaking gigs, right? Like, that sounds awful flying around. Like, you have this incredible schedule where you get to wake up and do whatever you want. Why would you then sacrifice that to be in a different city 20 weeks of the year, right? Like, I'm not going to try to like spin it into other businesses, right? Like, some writers find a niche that does really well. And then like, oh, cool, I'm just only writing books about this niche now. And then I'm going to like build a bunch of businesses around it. And they kind of like get worse and worse and worse and worse and worse over time. People can probably guess that.
You want to do the thing to do the thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, I, you know, my schedule right now is I wake up between 5:30 and 6, get up, go downstairs, make coffee. We have this like cool indoor-outdoor sunroom that I've been filling with plants. And I'll just like sit in there and write for an hour and a half while the sun comes up. And then our daughter wakes up at like 7:30. And by the time she's up, I've usually done 1,000 to 1,200 words, which is a win for the day. And then I can do whatever else I want the rest of the day. And if I can keep that for a long time, that's really all I like want to do or need to do, hopefully. Right. The hard thing is like not getting tempted by all the other stuff, because like you said, like, I do like to be early to things. It is fun to go like
and you're good at the rabbit holes.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And that's the other hard thing too, is like, you go down some of these entrepreneurship paths or whatever, and you develop these skills, and sometimes they're not skills that you actually want.
Go on that.
So, you know, one of the only like real jobs I ever had, I was like doing internet marketing for this tech company, and the like sales and marketing style was very aggressive. Mm-hmm. So I would get on these webinars. We do a lot of webinars and talk about, you know, oh, the product does like this and this and this, you know, it'll help you get more emails or whatever. And then the end was always this like very aggressive pitch, like, okay, well, if you sign up for the year right now, then you'll like save all this money and then you'll have it like locked in, you'll get like bonus coaching and whatever. And it wasn't like that good of a product. So we had to do these aggressive sales tactics, right? And that company went out of business and it never really worked out. And it made me feel kind of like yucky while I was doing it. And I told the founder, I was like, we shouldn't be like marketing stuff this way, right? And then he'd always say like, well, it's like, it's working, it's paying the bills and you're really good at it. And I was like, yeah, but it like doesn't feel right, right? And that was tough because like, I know how to do that. Mm. Or like, I know how to do the like super salesy marketing that gets clicks. So like with SEO, right? Like, I'm really good at SEO. Like, I know how to do it. I know how to like, you know, get a blog on whatever topic, like front page of Google within a reasonable amount of time. But sometimes you start to like hate the thing that you get good at, and you don't want that, right? Because then it's like, why did I spend all this time getting good at this thing that I now like loathe or resent myself for? And it's hard to like know that before you get into it though.
How do you make sure that doesn't happen with writing?
I think it's by continuing to just write like whatever the hell I feel like.
Yeah.
Because the times that I've started to resent it is when it feels like a chore to keep like mining some node that I've found that gets a lot of attention. And it's hard because that's often where the money is, right? You find a topic and then you just keep picking at it because it does super well and you like keep getting clicks, you know, signups, feedback, whatever.
Likes.
Yeah, like your audience keeps growing, but you kind of have to ask yourself sometimes, like, would I want to hang out with my audience? Right?
Great question.
And
for any creator.
Yeah, yeah. And a lot of people are like writing or creating down.
Mm.
Right? They want to build an audience of people who are just like sucking at their teat, like really excited for them to, you know, dole out the forbidden fruit of like being this, you know, rich, successful entrepreneur, influencer, or whatever. But they kind of like look down on them or they're like, you know, oh, these, you know, like wannabe me's or whatever. Like they wouldn't want to like have a conversation with them. They don't necessarily have that same like respect for them, but there's a lot more money in going that route of like, look at me, like, you know, superior person on high, like follow me, buy my courses, right? Like I have the secret knowledge that you need.
Yep.
Like that's where all the money is.
Yep.
Writing like up or over, right? Like that it, one, it's harder.
Yeah.
Right. Because then you have to like be good or and, like keep trying to get good
and grow.
Yeah. And grow. Also. And there's a lot less money in it because like the size is just smaller. You like get into weird esoteric topics and whatnot. But I kind of feel like a lot of us are like living life on easy mode, right? I mean, especially if you live in the US, right? If you live in the US and you like have all of your limbs and like graduated high school and college, like globally, you've kind of got life on easy mode, right?
Yeah.
Even if you have debt and like all these other challenges, right? And if you don't have a lot of those other challenges that even those like super privileged normal US people have, then you really like have to find ways, I think, to like ratchet up the difficulty if you want to have, I think, these kind of like interesting challenges.
Mm.
And so for me, it's like, I would be so much more satisfied just trying to go the like, get really good at writing and get positive feedback from the people I look up to than get really good at amassing, you know, like hundreds and hundreds of thousands of followers on some, whatever the hot new like social media platform is. And like it's not to knock people who want to do that necessarily. It's just like, for me, that's where the drive is. And I think where I would start hating writing is if I knew that I was doing it just to like bump up these numbers. Right. But I mean, like, it's fucking hard. Right? It's like, it feels good getting those subscribers, right? Like, it feels good selling stuff.
So how does, the book deal come into that, into that game? Because you just announced recently on Twitter, you're writing a book, your first book. I will be pre-ordering it as soon as I possibly can.
Thanks, man. Yeah, I'll have to send you some. I think you'll like some of the sample material. I'll have to send it over to you for feedback.
I love
that. So I've been working on it for a few months. It's been so much fun because, you know, going into crypto, I did have this like sort of weird, wild experience, both on the personal side, but also who I got exposed to and like some of the like events that I got to participate in. Right. And just as like a simple example, the team that I was working with, really through most of the time I was really heavily in crypto, this game called Crypto Raiders, one of the lead investors in their like seed round was Three Arrows Capital, the like, you know, firm that ended up like half destroying the entire market. And not only did they like invest in, and that was fine, right? Like they had a great reputation at the time. There was nothing like sketchy or bad about that. But where we started to feel like, is there something kind of fucked here? Was they then ran a like pump and dump scheme on the token leading up to the fundraising announcement.
Oh my God.
So, and you could see this all happening on chain, which was the crazy thing. It was so blatant, but they co-led the round with a couple other teams, and then they knew the announcement was coming out on like Friday.
Wow.
So in the weeks leading up to it, they started buying a bunch of additional tokens beyond what they had locked from their fundraiser. They started buying a bunch of additional tokens in their public wallets. And I think they knew that other people would see that it was them doing it. Because then other people start going, oh, like Three Arrows Capital is buying a bunch of this token. They know something.
Oh my God.
And they did know something. They knew the fundraising announcement was coming up. And so they pumped it from like $2 to $7 over the course of a week, got this like crazy 2 or 3x return outside of the normal investment. And then basically the minute the news came out, like dumped most of it.
Holy smokes.
Because they knew it was coming, right?
And you were, did you witness all this?
Yes.
Oh my God. How did that make you feel as somebody who prides themselves on like being ethical online and treat?
Dude, it's, I mean, it's fucking hard because, and this was a lot of my conflict with the crypto stuff too, is, you know, we were talking about like me getting interested in stuff and, you know, being early to things. That works out really well in crypto. The problem is by the time I would like be interested in something and then be comfortable enough with it to share it publicly, it was already too late for anybody else. And so I, you know, looking back on the stuff that I eventually mustered up the courage to talk about publicly, I pretty much always ended up doing it like at the peak.
Yeah.
At which point it had worked out very well for me.
Right.
But anybody who didn't like immediately follow me in at that point ended up kind of getting hosed.
Yep.
Because like by the time I was confident, it was just like too late. And so the
you were ready to sell by the,
well, I wasn't emotionally, right, but not on purpose. No, right. No, it was just like the timeline on these things was so fast.
Yes.
Right. That if I had been interested and curious and playing around with it for 2 months, then I probably got in at the right time. And by the time I was like good to talk about it, it was time to sell and get out. It wasn't time to like keep hyping it. So I lost money on basically every single thing that I wrote about because I, you know, once I wrote about it, I got like more excited and then like stayed in, you know, way past the peak. And you know, if I went back, if I just sold everything instead of writing about it, I would have done so much better. And that's kind of why I feel like weird about a lot of it now is like, was it bad to write about that stuff? Right. Like it helped other people who were interested, like learn about these things. But, you know, I definitely lost a lot of money on a lot of those. Other people definitely lost a lot of money on a lot of those too. And this was kind of my frustration with some of the like VCs pumping and dumping on crypto raiders and other projects is like, it's sort of the whole business model, right? Yeah. Like that's kind of how they make money is they, because they get really quick liquidity. Where it, you look at like A16Z or something, they invest in a project. It might be 10 years before that company IPOs or 15 years before the company IPOs. It's a long time for them to start to recoup their investment. You invest in a crypto project, you start getting some tokens in like 6, 12 months, right? Yeah. Maybe 18 months if it's really slow.
Yeah.
And so that time to liquidity is so much faster, which means they can start like talking about stuff way quicker. And that's how you have these projects with like almost no product getting pumped up to $100 million valuations, like purely on hype. It's because like, I mean, and this is the whole venture capital business model in general is dumping on retail. But in crypto, you can do it way faster, wow, right? It's like VCs don't make money until a company IPOs because then all of the like silly public buy into it. And most of the time, all of the, like a lot of the gains are gone, right? Especially these days. Like companies used to IPO way earlier. And so if you bought into like Amazon when it IPO'd or Google when it IPO'd, most of the gains were after that. You look at like an Uber or something that IPOs at $40 billion or whatever. And if you got in at a few million, you did insanely well. If you bought it when it IPO'd, you're basically just like paying back those seed investors to like go find the next really exciting thing. So crypto is basically that on steroids, where the VCs can put the money in early and like angels or like people who are just really early and in the community can put money in early, create a lot of hullabaloo when their tokens are about to unlock, and then they can just sell all their shit.
Wow.
So one of the tricks, if you want to like do well in crypto, is to know the unlock schedules. Because if you know that, okay, like Three Arrows or whoever the next era of like crypto VCs is going to be, if you know, okay, their tokens start unlocking on like this month, you just sell everything before that month. Because as soon as they get it, like they're just going to dump and recoup their investment and go like run the same playbook. And so seeing that from the inside really felt like, oh, you guys might not have even like believed in this project. You just saw another thing that you could run this playbook on and keep like growing your books.
Did you feel used?
No, I didn't feel used. I mean, I really liked the guys on the Crypto Raiders team. Gosh. And, you know, the head of it, Nick, we'd actually known each other from like the internet marketing world, which is how I like got looped in with that. And like, to their credit, they're really trying to like build a good video game with crypto elements. Like most of the people who are launching stuff were just trying to make money. And like, so I felt really good working with them, but we definitely felt used at times, I think. Well, I won't speak for them. I felt used at times by the VCs.
That's what I meant.
Yeah. Yeah. Where, and also other investors, right? Or like retail people who were putting money in because it was the thing that is really hard, and this is true for all companies, but especially in crypto, is it doesn't matter how good a project is or how good a team is or how smart the founders are or any of the stuff that you think matters. The only thing that matters is who has the most like control over the token and what are their incentives. Because if three or four or five like huge whales have enough supply to just like destroy the market, then they will, like, they'll cash out. They don't care how good the game or whatever is. Like, they just want to make money. And so even if you believe deeply in something, that is a weakness, because the people who are not emotional about it and are just trying to optimize for money will just sell on you and you'll be left like holding the bag at the end. So that kind of like sucks to realize. Like, you want to have this very like
utopian vision.
Yeah, like trusting, you know, we're doing like this great stuff here. And like you can be, but you can't like assume that that means the price will keep going up. Right. Like KlimaDAO is another great example of this. Like pulling carbon out of the atmosphere, using crypto as incentives, down like 99.99% because just mined the shit out of it to try to take as much money as possible. Right. Like, great idea. And quite good execution, but none of those things matter. All that matters is like who has the money and when will they sell, and will you be the one who's like left being the like emotional bag holder?
So is that what the book is primarily about?
No. So, I mean, that's part of it, right? Gotcha. Like, it's if
that's a chapter.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Or two. The story. Yeah. Expanded versions of all these stories are in it. But it's really like, it's not a, you know, how to or like what is crypto. A couple of those have been written. I think they're boring generally because it's such a techie field, and that book would be out of date in a month or two.
Yeah.
Right. It's much more if you've read like Liar's Poker or Chaos Monkeys or even like Ryan Holiday's Trust Me, I'm Lying, right? Where it's like, here is the like insider's experience of this industry. Here's how stuff like actually is working behind the scenes. Here's like what was going on during this like crazy period through the lens of like my experience with it, and my experience both like doing very well at some parts, you know, losing tons of money at other parts, like, you know, serious issues with like anxiety, and like I reached a point where I like basically couldn't sleep for a week.
Wow.
Because I had deployed this code that now had millions of dollars in it. And if something happened with it, I was the only one who knew how to fix it.
Oh my God.
And so it was like, okay, well, what if something happens like right after I go to sleep, right? Like, will anybody notice and will they tell me so I can get up and fix it? Right.
Holy. And you've already had this experience of losing $30,000.
Yeah. I've already been hacked once.
Yeah.
Right. But now it's much worse because it would be somebody else's money.
Right.
Right. And there's just like a lot of that kind of stuff from the inside. And so it's really like that whole journey through it. And so by the end, you'll have been like incepted with a lot of knowledge about crypto, but you're getting this like fun, action-packed kind of like roller coastery story to get there.
I can't wait to read. That sounds so
It's been
exciting.
A lot of fun. It's been really fun to write it.
How did you go about, or how did you get approached to get a book deal, and how has that process been in terms of announcing it, and what's the expected release date that you have right now?
Yeah, so I mean, shout out to a couple of people, Tiago Forte and Chris Guillebeau, both like wonderful friends, hugely supportive throughout like this whole process. You should go buy both of their books. And, you know, Tiago and I talked about it first because Tiago's book, Building a Second Brain, came out a few months ago, did super well. I've known Tiago since like 2017 now, 2018. I was in like an early Building a Second Brain cohort. He's probably influenced my like knowledge management organization more than anyone else, right? Like, his is really one of the only courses that I strongly recommend. And so when he was working on this book, we were talking about it a bit. And then I kind of like had this idea kicking around for a crypto book. And so I reached out to him and said, like, you know, hey, what was the process like for you? And he was super generous, like sent me his whole proposal, got on the call. He introduced me to his agent. You know, it didn't work out with her, but this is like a funny thing about the book industry is it's very like emotional and fit based. And so I talked to her.
Fit based? Like, how well do you fit with the agent?
Yeah. Yeah. If they're like excited about it, inspired about it, it's partially numbers driven and partially just like emotional.
Gotcha.
Right. And so she was sort of like, you know, this isn't really a good fit for me. Like, I don't know if this would be, you know, right. And then I talked to another agent, Chris's actually, and he was like, yes, like, let's go. Like, this is awesome. And I love him. He's wonderful. Oh, and it's just kind of a funny industry that way. So I really talked to like four agents or so. The guy that I'm working with, David, was like by far the most excited about it. And then you have to like write this proposal. And it's really different if you're doing fiction versus nonfiction. Fiction, you write the whole book.
Crazy.
If an agent likes it, then they'll go shop it to houses. There'll be like a little cover page that might say, you know, short stories you've had published or other books you've had published, whatever. But aside from that, it's basically just the book.
Wow.
And then editors at publishing houses will read it. And if they like it, they'll publish it. I'm like, that's it. With nonfiction, I was so blown away by this. Like, your writing is one of the less important elements, which explains why there are so many terribly written nonfiction books. Because the question is not necessarily like, how good of a book will this be? A lot of it is, will you make us our money back?
Mm-hmm.
And so the first, you know, my proposal was like 45 pages and 15 of that was like the table of contents and the sample chapter. And the other 30 pages were like, here's the idea. Here's my experience in the field. Here's why I should write it. Here's why now's the right time to write it. Here's who's going to read it. Here are other books that have done well in this space. And then really one of the most important things is like, here are all of my marketing assets.
Mm-hmm.
So here's my newsletter. Here's how many blog readers I get. Here's how many Twitter followers I have.
Yeah, I was shocked by you saying on Twitter that 50,000 newsletter subscribers is more impactful than a million SEO views.
Yeah, yeah, I was like, wow. Surprised by this too. But I think that email just converts so much better than cold traffic.
Personal connection.
Yeah, exactly. Like they know you. They're going to trust that you've made something good. And so, I had like blog visitors featured in my marketing assets, and my agent was like, "Oh, you know, you can kind of like move that down." He's like, "Your Twitter and your newsletter are like way more valuable than search traffic." And I said, "Okay, cool, right? Like, whatever, that's great." But I think it makes you realize is if you have, I'd say like 10,000 plus newsletter subscribers, you can probably get a book deal.
Mm.
It might not be the best deal, it might not be with the best house, right? Like you. But you can probably go get something because they'll probably feel confident making their money back on like if you have 10,000 subscribers at least. So one thing that I took away from it was I could have actually maybe tried to do a book earlier. I'm glad I didn't because I think that the reason this is good is like it's a personal story. Like I had this little experience, right? Like I'm really glad that I got to go out and do this and now tell this story. But it is also easier to get, I think, a book deal if you have some audience than a lot of people might think.
How does somebody get their first 10,000 subscribers on their newsletter?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, going back to like, what kind of subscribers do you want, right? Because I could say like, okay, you know, take a popular YouTube video from a year or two ago about like making money, probably the easiest niche, right? Like, so take a really popular YouTube from a year or two ago about making money, take all the most popular videos, copy the content, turn it into articles, publish them every week, like one or two a week, and like get really aggressive with Twitter threads. And you'll get there really quickly, right?
I don't want the hacky way to do it. I want the Natalized way to do it.
I mean, this is one of those weird things where I'm like, I don't even know if it's good advice because my writing career has been so weird.
Mm.
And I mean, it's literally just like I've been writing about whatever I feel like talking about for 2014. So what is that? 8 years now. whenever people are like giving advice on writing or audience building or whatever, the temptation, I think, is to look for individual tactics that will get you there. And that's always the mistake because the tactics change. And it's kind of like the talking about crypto projects, right? By the time somebody feels good enough about a tactic to talk about it publicly, they've probably milked all the alpha out of it and it's not as good anymore. So you can't just be like following people on Twitter or whatever and be like, okay, like that's how I, you know, build an audience. Like it's too late for that strategy, right? Like you've got to get ahead of it. But the one really consistent thing that is true of everybody who succeeds is just consistency.
Mm.
Like I've been thinking about this a lot, right? Because getting into book publishing, people, like everybody wants to give you advice and everybody has different ways of doing things. And there's different, you know, beliefs about the best way to, you know, whatever, right? Like there's a million, parenting is even worse. So parenting is the worst about this. But then the question is like, what's true 100% of the time?
Mm.
And the people who make it in like every creative industry are the ones who don't stop.
Mm.
Right. Like they just keep putting something out and then eventually they like hit into an audience that really likes their stuff or tap into, you know, some niche, or they have like a really great creative period that carries them for years. And I think especially with writing, there's a temptation of like, oh, I have to publish something every week. But I talk to people fairly often who will say, not like that often, I'm not that popular. Every now and then, yeah, like I talk to somebody and they say, oh, you know, I really loved your article on like decomplication. And I wrote that 5 years ago, right? Wow. But they really loved that one article, and that one thing that they loved was enough to stay like kind of in my orbit for a long time. And so you don't – like not every single thing has to be a banger. Mm. Like you've got to have a few bangers a year. Mm. And if they're really good, that'll kind of like hook your name into people's minds. And they'll probably like come back later the next time something like really great rolls around. So I think it's – that's why the consistency works, is you just like slowly build a couple of like really good hits over a really long period of time. And then you suddenly have an audience of some size.
How confident are you in your ability to predict what is going to connect with people at a deep level?
Connect pretty well, because I mean, the easiest way to write something that really connects with people is like, you know, how honest can I be in this and how afraid am I to publish it? Because when you write about stuff that you're really afraid to like talk about because it's so like vulnerable and revealing, that's always what people are going to resonate with. Because, and this is like, I don't know, maybe this will be the next book, or I want to write about this more. There are really only like a dozen or so fundamental human problems, right? It's like, am I worthy of love, right? Like, is my family, you know, safe, right? Like, do I have like the respect of my peers in my community, right? Like, these are all like very fundamental issues, and we're all dealing with them in our own ways. And so when you talk about your struggles with one of those, it lets everybody else know that they're like not the only one, right? It's like everybody's really insecure. Everybody's really worried about a lot of the same stuff. Like the richest people are really worried about money and the poorest people are really worried about money, right? The richest people are worried about like their family and stuff. The people with like no kids and lots of kids, they're all worried about family stuff, right? Like everybody's worried about how they look, worried if they're like respected, right? It's all the same shit. And everybody's like sitting in their house or like listening to their podcast going like, you know, oh, like nobody else like understands my problems, right? Like they're so personal. It's like, no. Everybody's the exact same fucking problems. And we're all just like pretending that we don't. And so if you can like talk about that really openly without, and there's a line here, right? Like, people might remember like James Altucher had like this crazy blogging period, and he like took it too far where it was like, okay, you're clearly like milking your insecurities
or vulnerability.
Stuff. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. It's like you're taking this too far.
Cause right? It's funny when you mentioned that about, I thought, oh, James Altucher said, I don't press publish unless I'm scared to write it.
Yeah.
But I didn't follow his journey too far. Your perspective, he went,
I think he got too excited about the engagement he was getting from it.
Gotcha.
And so he was like, okay, I'm just going to write every article like I'm this horrible, loathsome piece of shit who's like miserable. And like, maybe he is, I don't know. But after a certain point, it was like, okay, dude, like you've kind of like milked this thing enough, right? Like you can't be doing it all the time.
It's funny that you say that, because I spoke to him and I thought there was a real genuineness in his being upset. Like, I don't know what specific scenario you're talking about, but like him, when he wrote that New York is dead and then Seinfeld came at him, like that like really hurt him like 6 months later, where he was willing to be open with that on the podcast about it. And I thought that was interesting. And maybe he is somebody who feels depression or feels upset more deeply than other people.
Yeah, I honestly don't know, because I'm talking about stuff from like 4 years ago.
Right.
So I haven't like kept up with it. That was just like the first example that came to mind of like, he hit it really, really well for a while, and then I felt like it just went too far.
Yeah, maybe that's possible that it is because you, in that scenario, would have figured out ways to get yourself out of it quicker.
Maybe.
And therefore, you said to yourself, huh, like, I wouldn't be in this scenario anymore. I wouldn't be writing these thoughts anymore.
Maybe. I don't know. I think that, like, and this could just be a personal thing, right?
Yeah.
I feel like we all have a fairly well-tuned like authenticity sense, right?
Interesting.
And so like there was just a point where it suddenly felt less authentic.
And right? I'd love to like you obviously don't have the blog post in front of you, but like, I'd love to like be like, what exactly is it about this that feels less authentic?
I know, because it's a really hard line to walk. And I feel bad that I'm like calling out James now, because I didn't actually mean to like turn into a big discussion about him.
Yeah,
and,
no, like, I didn't mean to harp on it, but I just had to.
There are people that I would, you know, happily call, but like, I haven't stayed up on his stuff too much. That was just one that came to mind.
Yeah.
But you're right. It's like, there's, you know, where is that like line? And that's why I think good writing over a long period of time is so hard, is because it's really difficult to like just sit in a room and read and write and create interesting stuff. Like, you have to go do things.
Yeah.
Right. It's like, everybody wants to be Hemingway. Nobody wants to be like an alcoholic war veteran. Right. Like, you have to go have these crazy experiences that inspire like where all of the ideas and the creativity come from. And that could be part of where this like authenticity line is you can like tap into those experiences for a great like book or blog post or like, you know, series or whatever. But then when you keep like reusing the same stuff, you've kind of like drained it dry and it starts to feel a little bit hollow. And it like, you know, I have no idea how to like put that into like a practical term, right? Like, it's very, you know, like, you know it when you see it type of thing. But the thing that I worry about with writing is like, okay, now I have to go like have other cool life experiences too. It's like, the writing part is actually kind of easy, right? It's like, okay, you sit down and you get to like scream into the void and people like pay attention to you. It's awesome, right? The hard part is like having interesting stuff to say, and where does that come from?
It's interesting though, because I wonder, not all, I don't know. Do all great writers lead interesting lives? Like, the first person to come to mind is James Clear, who I view as a great writer, but I think he just like chills and works out and like stays in Ohio, and it's not like he's going crazy drinking alcohol, to my knowledge. So I don't know. Is that a fallacy that we need to lead interesting lives to write interesting things?
So I think James would probably say that, like, and I shouldn't say James would probably say this. My question would be, what does James do after Atomic Habits? Right? Because he has led this very interesting life of being obsessed with improving like human well-being and performance and habitual action, like all this stuff. Like, he was so obsessed with that topic for so long. He built the best blog in the world on this topic, like 2 million subscribers talking about this topic. He created the best-selling book in the world in like nonfiction for multiple, I think 2 years in a row.
Insane.
Right? Because he was like so obsessed and so into this area. What does he do next?
Yeah.
Right.
And I've heard him say that he wants to do something else, but I haven't seen anything about his next chapter.
So that would be my fear, right? Yeah. And I'm sure that's like something he's really struggling with, right? Is like, how does he follow that up?
Yeah. Especially when the first one is the king. Like, imagine, let's imagine the book that you write gets seen by all the places, goes everywhere, millions and millions of copies sold. And now what?
I know. Well, and this is actually like, this is a hard thing where a lot of writers' best books are one of their earlier ones.
Well, a lot of musicians' best albums.
Yeah, it's like when they're younger, right? Like, I think what Elton John is doing right now is really cool, where he's like remixing his old best stuff with the new up-and-coming artists. And now he's like topping charts again.
Wow.
Because he's like tapping into that creativity he had when he's young and like mixing it with, you know, Dua Lipa and other like up-and-coming artists, or like established popular young artists. And, you know, but he, you know, he went, I think, decades without like a chart topping hit. And it's this question of like, okay, you, this is a, whatever, I'll say this, right? Like, if you do MDMA, right, like Molly or like LSD, they often say like the first time you do it is like so powerful and you can almost never recapture that, because you have all this like pent up energy, like all of this new experience and whatever that's coming into it. And with like MDMA specifically, you have like extra built up serotonin and stuff that gets released and flushed into your system. And then you might like keep chasing that later and never fully recapture that experience. And so your like first book or your first like really great article after a major life experience, you might unleash so much energy into that that it'd be very hard to like build up the potential energy for something as good again, right? And you might not even have the energy to do it, because you know, when you're like young and trying to prove yourself and like working crazy hard, you're going to just grind like crazy. And then, oh, you know, okay, you've like made some good money. You've got like a nice life. You're like going on podcast interviews. Right? Like, I'll write in my free time, right? Like you just don't have the same like drive for it. And I think that's what scares me. That's one of the things that scares me is like, because I'm pretty good at ignoring what other people have done well or like how other people have succeeded, but not living up to my past self would be really hard. Like it, I like when people say it, but it also makes me sad when somebody says they loved an article I wrote 4 years ago. Oof. Because then I'm like, fuck, have I like not written anything good since then?
Right? That's the old me. Yeah. They love the old
yeah,
Kanye.
Yeah, I'm like, yeah, fuck that guy. Like, that dude was an idiot, right? Like, you liked his writing? Like, it's so much better now. But they're not talking about a new thing. They're talking about an old thing. And it's like, oh God, like, have I already done my best article, right? Mm. Like, is there never going to be another article that gets as many like hits as that one? Mm. Or that people resonate with as much as that one? And that's like a scary thought, right? Like that's sort of the ultimate fear, mm-hmm. right? Or it's like my favorite conception of hell, right? Is that you just meet the version of you that you could have been, right? Like you're always, I feel like, or after a certain point, you can always just be freaking out about like, okay, have I already peaked? Mm-hmm. Or have I already like, you know, or am I never going to reach this like ideal in my head? And that's sort of like the hardest form of, or it's one of the hardest forms of suffering, I think, to deal with, but everybody's dealing with it, right? Probably to some extent.
100%.
Yeah.
Who's the form or the ideal in the writing arena that you look to, or the people you look to? It doesn't have to be present, could be past, where you're like, that person or those people do it or are doing it right.
Hmm. Hmm. Two names come to mind. I'd say the first one's definitely David Foster Wallace. Mm. So, his nonfiction stuff is great. And like his essays are wonderful. Infinite Jest is a really special book. And I didn't totally get it the first time I read it, and now I'm rereading it. And it's really like coming through so much stronger where, you know, David Foster Wallace clearly struggled so deeply with, like his own insecurities around his writing. And you read his writing and it's some of the best writing by anybody ever, right? Like it's incredible. And he was so depressed, like drug addicted, miserable because he didn't think he was good enough, right? And like Infinite Jest is a fiction story about partially, you know, in part, and this isn't a spoiler, you learned this very early, in part about an artist trying to create something called Infinite Jest, trying for years and years and years, never getting sufficiently happy with it and killing himself. And that's what happened, right? Like
he wrote the story of his own life.
Yeah, it's so autobiographical. And so you read these chapters talking about people in the book struggling with drug addiction, not being good enough, with like these emotional challenges. And it's so raw and like it's clearly so true. And you know it's true because it's like he was clearly going through these exact same emotions. Mm. Like he clearly put himself into each of these characters. And it's so true while also being hilarious and very clever and witty and like all these things where you're reading the like bleakest, most depressing, awful shit, and then you're laughing, you know, halfway through the page too. He could balance this stuff in such an interesting way. And so in terms of like respect for being able to combine that like authentic vulnerability, telling the truth about yourself and the world, you know, through writing, like him, hands down. It's just the best. It's so good. And then in terms of like another similar version of that I think is kind of interesting take is Shakespeare. Mm. Because I've been doing this project, like trying to read through all of the old, like great books. And I'm nowhere close to Shakespeare yet. I've got like 1500 years to go. But the thing that I didn't realize until I like organized all the books for this project is part of what makes Shakespeare great was he was just prolific, right? Like obviously incredible playwright, but he succeeded in like fiction and nonfiction, right? So he would like make up stories, but he would also tell historical stories. It's very hard to do both fiction and nonfiction. Most people can't really do both very well. Hmm. He succeeded in plays and sonnets and poetry and like a lot of other stuff. And Shakespeare has like 20 bangers. Like, I was going through the list of, you know, who, you know, what people think should be on the, like, greatest, you know, great books of all time, if you're listing like top 300 or 400, and Shakespeare got like 15 of them.
Wow.
And nobody comes close.
Wow.
Like, anybody else on the list has a good 3 or 4 if they're like really, really prolific. Prolific.
Yes.
And then there's Shakespeare.
Wow.
And the dude just knew how to do it. He was so good at, like, not, I don't know what it was. Like, he didn't let previous success, like, stop him from putting out something else great. Maybe he wasn't, you know, super, like, in his head. Maybe he was, like, always trying to do something better, right? I don't know what it was. I kind of want to, like, read some more biographies or something, because I want to know, like, what, like, drove this guy. How did he do this? Because it's so rare,
yeah.
Right? And that's cool, right? And, you know, I'm definitely a dilettante at heart. I want to just, like, give up on the thing I'm getting good at and go try something new.
What was that word?
Dilettante.
Yeah, what does that mean?
It's like somebody who doesn't really commit to something in work. They, like, pick a new thing and they're like, oh, you know, I'll get, like, 80% of the way there and then I'll go try something else, right?
I'll build the city.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I still think that's a good idea.
I just need
a lot of money and a lot more time. But, you know, I really love the idea of, like, going off and trying all these different things, or, like, trying to, you know, maybe I will try to do a fiction book, or I will try to do these other very different things. And there's part of my brain that says, no, like, you have to keep focusing on this one thing, because otherwise you will never become great at anything.
Mm.
Right. And I want to be great at something. But then you look at, like, a Shakespeare or, Ayn Rand is kind of an example of this too, where, and, like, much lower tier example of this than Shakespeare, but there aren't a lot of people who, like, write really popular philosophy and really popular fiction. I really can't think of anybody besides her that's done that at scale, right? And then, you know, I think Shakespeare's probably the ultimate example of somebody who's, like, fiction, nonfiction, other stuff, like, clearly incredibly commercially successful and intellectually successful. Like, that's also really hard, right? To make something that, like, uber snobby smart people really like in academia and sells, like, millions of copies. Almost nobody does that.
Well, what was so fascinating about Shakespeare was that the reason why his books became plays is because he wanted to get his ideas to the masses.
Yeah, I love that.
It's, like, similar to somebody doing a podcast or writing blog posts and then being like, how can I make these YouTube videos? And then how can I make them TikToks?
Yeah.
And, or doing a podcast and chopping it up into clips, because you want to get the ideas out to everyone.
Totally.
And so it's fascinating that Shakespeare was the original TikToker.
It's almost, like, yeah, yeah.
If you think
the original, like what's the term, like, repackager
of content. Yeah.
Yeah. Or he at least he knew his mediums.
Yeah.
Right. And that well, no, that doesn't really make sense. I mean, I'm trying to think if there was a technological thing that gave him an advantage at the time. I don't think there was. He was just good.
Yeah.
And that's really cool.
Yeah.
Right. But the, you know, talking about, like, people who influence you or inspire you, the thing I've really just been trying to do more of is, like, not consume anything recent or like new. Very rare, right? Like, I'm almost entirely off Twitter in terms of, like, the feed. I've been using Buffer. And so I'll, like, write tweets in Buffer on my phone, so they just go out, so I don't have to, like, log on to Twitter and get, like, sucked in by the feed. And I'm really never on Instagram, not using the news at all. Like, I use Reddit for, like, history and, like, houseplants and, like, those kinds of things, but keeping all the news stuff out of there. And it's been so nice.
Mm.
Like, it's amazing how good life actually is if you don't have people telling you all the time that the world is fucked and you're going to die, like, tomorrow. If you, like, just go outside and look around and, you know, breathe fresh air and go for a run and hang out with your friends and cook food, like, life is pretty awesome. Like, it's great. And that's been so nice. It's been so refreshing.
What do you think is happening where the voices or so much of the world is telling you that it's going to end?
Mm.
What do you think is happening there? Why is that the common theme that you notice when you're online?
Well, you know, one thing that I think is kind of interesting is, like, you have to think about how we got here, right? So millions of years of human evolution, much longer than that, if you think about, you know, pre-Homo sapiens and whatnot. And so then you think, okay, like, what characteristics led to survival? And attunement to danger is probably the biggest one.
Yeah.
Because if you were just completely ignorant of dangers and threats around you, you probably didn't make it very long. You probably didn't reproduce, right? And so our brains are definitely wired to look for sources of potential, you know, threats and predators and whatever. And we have like the cushiest, easiest, safest lives imaginable, right? Like this is the most, the idea that like, oh, the world is so terrible and dangerous now is like the most brain dead take ever, right? The world is incredible now, especially if you live in the West. Like you can just put your mouth under any sink in America and you're not going to die.
Yeah.
Right. Like you can go to a grocery store. You don't have to hunt shit anymore. You don't have to figure out like what berries are poisonous or not. You just like buy your food and go home and cook it. Mm. Right. I was reading The Pioneers by David McCullough. I wasn't reading it. I was listening to it. And it, like listening to what these early settlers, and this is like 1800s, it's not that long ago. It's like three people ago were doing in Ohio. They would, you know, go down the river. Five families would like build some log cabins and then they would all get just like killed by Indians randomly in the middle of the night.
Oh my God.
We don't have to deal with that. Yeah. Right. But we're still looking out for things that might threaten us or, you know, those same problems, right? Is my family safe? Am I safe? Right. Like, mm-hmm. can I trust my community? Or like, do I have like all of these things? We're always looking for stuff that might be hurting us. And so that stuff does well because it scratches that itch. It tells people like, oh, no, you need this information or else you won't be privy to this threat. But almost all of those threats are made up, right? Mm. Like, yes, climate change is an issue. Like, yes, COVID was an issue. Like, yes, a lot of these things are problems, but they are not problems that require your 24/7 like maintenance and awareness of. And if you tune into that, there will always be something else to like make you scared and scratch that itch. And it's crazy that you have to turn it off now. There's a lot of human instincts that we just have to try to like turn off or like, you know, I think about us as having like two brains. There's like the, you know, the smart like human brain. And then there's like the monkey brain or like the elephant and the rider or like Plato's chariot. There's a lot of versions of this, but most of your brain wants to like eat junk food and watch the news and like do all of this shit that like scratches those primal urges. And we basically just have to constantly fight that. Right. You have to be really diligent about the food that you eat, because if you just eat default American diet, you're going to be like really overweight. Mm. Right. You have to be really diligent about the information you consume, because if you consume the default American information diet, you're probably going to be like anxious, lonely, depressed, like sitting in your house, terrified of shit. Mm. If you like, I mean, even the water, right? Like the lengths you have to go through to like not get water that's full of like plastic phthalates and shit. Right. Like it. So much stuff is kind of just like, yeah. It's like, it's wild. Like the problems are completely shifted. All the things that our brains are wired to be worried about, we now have to like actively avoid. And we have to worry about like the opposite versions of them, right? You used to just like naturally get a ton of exercise because you had to build your house and you had to hunt for food and forage and shit. Now your default is like sitting alone in a box for 12 hours a day.
Looking at a box.
Yeah. Looking at variously sized pieces of glass, wondering why you're alone and unhappy. It's like, yeah, you have to go outside and like move and do shit or else you're just going to be like miserable and overweight. Like it's really kind of like fucked up how much you have to fight that default programming. Mm. So I think it's just like the newsfeed is the worst example of it. Mm. Right. It's like there's always something new there to scratch one of those itches. And whether that's like, you know, oh, there's some like horrible new, you know, like monkeypox or whatever that you need to be like terrified of, you know, no more going to orgies. Or it's like, you know, there's this like new way to make money that like you don't know about. And if you don't like try this, then like you're not going to make it. There's a new note-taking app. And if you don't use it, like you're never going to write anything good. Like 99.99% of all writing has ever been good. Writing has ever been done with just like a word processor or a typewriter. Like you don't need fancy fucking apps for this stuff.
Talk it. Tell them.
Yeah. It's just like.
Someone needs to say it.
And I've promoted a lot of this stuff and talked about it a lot too, right? And so this is like, you know, the resentment for past stuff a little bit, where now I'm like, okay, that was just like a way to like procrastinate, right? It's like almost all productivity stuff is just procrastination in disguise. Mm. It's like almost every great company, every like great piece of art, every like great project ever was done without the app that you suddenly think you need to use to do the thing, right? Like, I tell this story a lot where we had a family friend through my mom who He was a lawyer, and then he left to start like a real estate investment trust. And he and his partner grew it to like 100 million plus in real estate under management in like record time. Mm. And, you know, incredible real estate entrepreneurs, like super, super sharp dude. He had his assistant print out emails and bring them to him. And then he would dictate responses to the emails, and then she would send them. He did not know how to use email. And this was like 10 years ago. Or like it wasn't that long, like no BlackBerry, like none of this stuff, right? He was just like, no, you know, I'm really great at real estate and I don't care about all this other stuff. It's like the things that you think you need to succeed in a lot of stuff, you really often don't. They're just like these little panaceas, or I think what a lot of it is we want to believe that there are like hacks and shortcuts and stuff to like save us from having to work hard and get really good at stuff. And there are kind of, you can get like really popular, or very successful for short periods of time, but then they don't last, right? Like if you build like a huge audience doing like TikTok dances, that is not probably a super universalizable skill. There are subsections of that, right? Like, you know, knowing how to understand a feed that you can game, or like knowing how to engage with the community. And like a lot of those are useful, but picking kind of like these skills that have this super long time horizon and that are like always valuable, I think is going to be like, it's a way better bet. Whereas if you're always like jumping onto the new thing and obsessing over that and not obsessing over the like underlying fundamental thing, then it's going to be very hard to have like success over a long period of time. The people who are obsessing over, okay, how do I like game Twitter versus how do I become an amazing writer or how to become an amazing interviewer, right? It's like that takes you so much further than like gaming the system. But this is one like very sad thing that you learn in SEO is nobody searches for like how to get good at stuff. They search for how to like cheat the system and how to like skip a bunch of steps and whatever, right? And that's what people are looking for. They're looking for like the hacks and shit, but it never pays off long term.
And when you are actually willing to do the hard thing for a longer amount of time, you make the competition nearly infinitesimal because no one's willing to do that.
Yeah, hopefully.
But right. Yeah, now we've almost run out on time, but it's flown by. I have so much stuff I want to talk to you
about. I know. Sorry. But I ramble. I tell stories.
No, it was all amazing. I'd love for you to end this podcast with a challenge for people. It could be in the vein of writing, creativity, anything. It could abundance, whatever you want. Because I feel like a challenge speaks to our heart and speaks to what we want to impose or help people with in their own journey. So what challenge can you leave people with for the end of this podcast?
I'd say like no feeds for a week is a good one. I think a week is enough time. And especially if you are trying to like build a business or trying to like stay in touch with friends or whatever you think you need a feed-based service for, try just like not doing it for a week and seeing what happens. Because I've always had this idea in my head that, oh, I need to be really active on Twitter because that's helping my newsletter, right? Like I've always been active on Twitter. Newsletter keeps growing. These things are related. And then I went canoe camping for a week and didn't post a tweet or anything. My like article went out, you know, automatically. The tweet went up automatically. I came back and subscriber growth was like literally unchanged. And then I said, okay, well, this is kind of interesting. What if I just keep being like barely active on Twitter for a couple more weeks and see what happens? And kept just going like exactly as it had before. And it was this just crazy, like, have I just been lying to myself this whole time? Right? Like, was this just a distraction, right? Of like, you know, trying to, you know, I was having fun scratching this itch. And so I told myself it was good for me when it really wasn't. Right. And the other thing that's like, I don't know, maybe a hot take, some people probably disagree with me, but like, I don't think remote friendships are like that natural or like good. Mm. Like, I think that if you have a very close friend who you then end up living separately from, like, yes, it makes sense to try to like maintain that, stay close. But if you're spending all of your time talking to people who are not around you physically, like that's not really a relationship. Mm. Like physical space is really important, right? Like getting, you know, not just like getting outside and everything, but having a space that makes you feel good and not trapped, like seeing people's facial expressions and emotions and even like, you know, smelling them. They say people who lose their sense of smell can't build as deep of relationships because they can't like pick up on these little like pheromonal changes and stuff that you get when you're interacting with people. And so if you're spending all of your time like getting feed-based friendships, you're not really like maintaining friendships, I think. And if you can like deprioritize that and prioritize instead like doing things in person, right? Like going outside, hosting people more. You know, this is one of the biggest unlocks I realized when moving to Austin is everybody wants to go to dinner parties. Nobody wants to host them. Like, and you know, I know you did an interview with Nick, right? Like he's the expert at this. It's like, just start hosting more stuff, right? And it's amazing how much time, energy, and like anxiety you unlock when you turn off the like the feed, the scrolling of any sort. And it changes. I have an article on this. This is my one plug, Looks of Entertainment. I think it was a good article. Basically, like it changes your interaction with information from passive receiver to like active searcher. And so you're no longer just letting the universe decide what gets your attention. You're saying, this is what I want my attention to go towards right now. And that I think is just such a healthier way to interact with like information, the world, people, all that. So that'll be the challenge.
Well, if you want feeds, you can check out Nat Eliason down below and all of his links. Follow this man, brilliant writer. Thank you so much, Nat, for taking the time.
Thanks for having me on.